effect, what began in the years 1931 to 1941 were a series of regional and largely unconnected wars in Asia and Europe that became partially fused in late 1941, but only partially. Russia and Japan, for example, remained at peace until August of 1945. Secondly, the dictators who ran the Axis powers did not seize power against the will of their peoples. The Nazis, for example, were the largest party in Germany during the early 1930s, and Adolf Hitler had made crystal clear that if he was elected and made chancellor, he would destroy the Weimar Republic. Furthermore, he, as well as Benito Mussolini in Italy and General Hideki Tojo in Japan, took power with the acquiescence and or connivance of the existing powers that be in each of these three countries. One must understand in this regard the enormous worldwide appeal during the interwar years of the ideology of fascism, an ideology with deep roots in the 19th century Romantic movement. Fascism opposed capitalism and communism. It also opposed democracy and individualism. It worshipped war, and it held that true freedom lay in acting as part of a group, not individually, with a single dictatorial leader serving as the incarnation of the group's spirit, or Volksgeist in German. Now, this ideology arose and gained enormous popularity during the interwar years as a result of World War I and the Great Depression, which was viewed as the failure of capitalism and democracy. It also had enormous emotional appeal on its own, an appeal that Americans find difficult to comprehend. My students, when I describe this, freedom is not individualism, being part of a group, they look at me as if I'm a bit nuts. What I use as an analogy often is to ask them how they feel when they go to a huge rock concert, that surge of energy that comes with all those people around you and the feeling of being part of that mass. And then I show them Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will, where you see that mass in uniforms. Third, and again in contrast to the popular version of the war, the historical reality is that despite their common ideology, the Axis powers were united in name only. They distrusted each other. They never coordinated their military activities. They never informed each other of their planned moves. Hitler, for example, never told the Japanese about either the Nazi-Soviet pact or his intention to invade Russia in 1941. Consequently, the Japanese, in April of 41, signed a neutrality treaty with the Russians. Mussolini never told Hitler that he intended to invade Greece. The alliance was basically a diplomatic bluff designed to scare potential adversaries into inaction via the threat of having to fight all of them rather than just one. Fourth, the United States was not isolationist during this time period, or as we previously saw, at any other time period during its history. Despite its refusal to join the League, it remained quite active in world affairs throughout the interwar years. Indeed, its economic power and policies had undergirded the entire peace structure of the 1920s, and its isolationism in the 1930s, as expressed in the Neutrality Acts, was limited to a belief that entry into World War I had been an avoidable mistake not to be repeated should a second great war erupt in Europe. Fifth, appeasement was not a new policy by any means during the 1930s. Nor was it or is it a dirty word. The British had practiced appeasement vis-a-vis Germany during the 1920s as well as the 1930s, as had the United States. And it is one of the oldest principles and practices in the history of diplomacy. Indeed, it's one of the oldest practices between human beings as well. When was the last time, for example, that you appeased a friend or a family member, or they appeased you? The problem in the 1930s was that Hitler was unappeasable. Successful appeasement is usually based on some shared desires and values, something totally absent when Hitler dealt with the British. Indeed, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was not a diplomat or a soldier. He was a businessman before he became a politician who incorrectly believed that Hitler was a businessman too, who shared his values. Needless to say, that was not the case. Furthermore, while appeasement did allow Hitler to begin the war enormously strengthened by the previous appeasement, especially at Munich in 1938 regarding Czechoslovakia, it also helped the British. It allowed them to be much better militarily prepared for war in 1939 than they had been at the time of the Munich Conference. They also went to war in 1939 with the full backing of the Commonwealth countries as well as the British public, which they would not have had in 1938. Sixth, the Axis bid for total victory in 1940 and 1941 was halted not by American material aid, but by the continued and successful resistance of the Chinese in Asia and in Europe of first the British and then the Russians. Finally, U.S. material aid to these countries did not lead to the Pearl Harbor attack. Rather, it was American economic sanctions against Japan in 1940-41, combined with Japanese reliance on U.S. oil and steel that was now cut off, plus the opportunities Hitler's European victories created for the Japanese to now obtain these resources in Southeast Asia. That is what led them to decide to conquer the European and American colonies in the area. The attack on Pearl Harbor was designed to remove the threat to the flank of their southward movement that was presented by the U.S. fleet, which Roosevelt had moved from its California base to Pearl Harbor as a deterrent against Japanese expansion. A deterrent, however, is also a target. And Hitler had utterly nothing to do with it. Nor did Roosevelt. The backdoor to war thesis relies upon information not available to Roosevelt and his advisors. Proponents of the backdoor to war thesis, for example, say, the United States had broken the Japanese codes. How could they not know the attack was coming? Well, the United States had broken the Japanese diplomatic code, not the highest naval code. The Americans knew war was coming, but they expected the attack to hit the Philippines, not Pearl Harbor, given where the Japanese troop ships were sailing. The Americans did not have a lack of information. They had too much information, what in the intelligence business is known as noise. And how do you separate the intelligence that can help you versus the intelligence that is not relevant? The critics also say, the aircraft carriers were not in Pearl Harbor. The battleships were, and the battleships were dated. But that was not known on December 7th, 1941. It was only with Pearl Harbor, followed by Coral Sea and Midway, that it was clear that the aircraft carrier had replaced the battleship. Furthermore, any conspiracy like this would have had to involve the entire cabinet, the Army and Navy Chief of Staff, the Secretaries of War and Navy. It would have also required Roosevelt to believe that Hitler would obey a treaty he had signed for the first time in his life, and indeed that he would go beyond the terms of the Tripartite Pact. The Tripartite Pact had established only a defensive alliance in the event that one of the three powers was attacked by a presently neutral power, meaning the United States. Why Hitler declared war on the United States anyway, when he didn't have to, has puzzled historians ever since. It has led to numerous hypotheses. All that is absolutely clear is that this move, Hitler's declaration of war on the United States, did link the existing regional wars that already existed, though not completely as previously noted. Let's now turn our attention to numerous myths about fighting and winning the war and losing the peace. Our collective memory holds that we were primarily, indeed almost single-handedly, responsible for the total military victory over the Axis powers. We provided our allies with critically needed military supplies free of charge via the Lend-Lease program. Simultaneously, we undertook a massive military as well as an economic mobilization that placed over 15 million Americans in uniform and enabled us to equip them and our allies simultaneously. We then deployed our uniform forces around the world. We destroyed the German and Italian armies in major battles in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Western Europe. We then destroyed the Japanese Army and Navy in the Central and Southwest Pacific theaters in such major battles and campaigns as Midway, Guadalcanal, MacArthur's leapfrogging in New Guinea and the Philippines, the Navy's Central Pacific advance, and major naval victories over the Japanese Navy in the Philippine Sea and Leyte Gulf. Then in 1945, you had Iwo Jima and Okinawa. At the same time, by this interpretation, our air forces destroyed German and Japanese war production and German and Japanese cities, culminating in the atomic bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki and ended the Pacific War. Our collective memory also holds that during the war, we realized that we had made a terrible mistake at the end of World War I by refusing to join the League of Nations. We also realized that we had now been granted a second chance to correct this error and achieve Woodrow Wilson's dream by joining a new international collective security organization, the United Nations. But this time we would not be as naive as Woodrow Wilson. This time there would be no talk of disarmament. Such talk only encouraged power-mad dictators. Instead, we would maintain our military strength. Munich and Pearl Harbor had been our lessons regarding the awful consequences of military unpreparedness as well as appeasement. As President Harry Truman stated in an October 27, 1945, Navy Day speech, this time there would be no full demobilization of the United States Armed Forces. Why? Because, quote, we have learned the bitter lesson that the weakness of this great republic invites men of ill will to shake the very foundations of civilization all over the world. We seek to use our military strength solely to preserve the peace of the world, for we know that this is the only sure way to make our own freedom secure. Franklin D. Roosevelt's great failure, Americans would soon argue, had been his inability to see such a man of ill will, a new Hitler, in his Soviet wartime ally, Joseph Stalin. Along with his naive and futile attempt to appease Stalin, most notoriously at the 1945 Yalta Conference, where he supposedly gave away half of the world to the Soviet dictator for worthless promises of free elections in Europe that Stalin quickly broke, Soviet entry into the war against Japan, which was totally unnecessary in light of the atomic bomb, and useless agreement to join what turned out to be the useless UN. The result of such naivete and appeasement was the Cold War. That is the popular version. But what were the realities of fighting the war and losing the peace, as opposed to this collective memory of it? For a start, World War II was not won by the United States alone, but by an allied coalition whose other members contributed at least as much as the United States. While the United States did put more than 15 million Americans into uniform, that constituted only 12% of its population. That is one of the lowest mobilization percentages for any major belligerent in the war. And American forces constituted only 25% of Allied forces during the war. The United States did, however, produce more than 50%, indeed nearly two-thirds, of all the war material used by the Allies to defeat the Axis powers. It was able to do this both because of the size of its enormous economy and its protected geographic position behind two large oceans, The United States was the only major belligerent in World War II not invaded or bombed. At least as important as this U.S. contribution to the war was the contribution of Great Britain and the Commonwealth countries. They played a major role in every victory claimed by the Americans in the North African, Mediterranean, and European theaters, including Normandy, where they took and held 3 of the 5 total beaches. SHAEF, Eisenhower's headquarters, stands for Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces, not Supreme Headquarters American Expeditionary Forces. Indeed, while the British were and remain tremendously grateful for the American aid they received, it is important to note that the war would have ended in total German victory in the spring or summer of 1940 without the British decision and success in fighting alone. Indeed, in British minds, we traded our weapons for British blood during that time period. The British also found the Americans to be hypocritical and naive. British wartime Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden once said, "Soviet policy is amoral. U.S. policy is exaggeratedly moral, at least where non-American interests are concerned." One British Foreign Office official referred in 1944 to U.S. foreign policy as, quote, "an unwieldy barge liable to wallow as a menace to navigation without a British pilot." Future British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan told a subordinate in North Africa during the war that, quote, "We are Greeks in this new American empire. You will find the Americans much as the Greeks found the Romans, great, big, vulgar, bustling people, more vigorous than we are, and also more idle, with more unspoiled virtues, but also more corrupt. We must run Allied Force headquarters in Algiers," Macmillan said, "as the Greek slaves ran the operations of the Emperor Claudius." As for the Soviets, their contribution to victory and their ensuing casualties dwarfed those of both the United States and Great Britain. U.S. combat deaths in World War II were 291,557. Total deaths were approximately 405,000. Combat deaths, 291,557. The Russians had at least that many dead in the single battle of Stalingrad. Total U.S. and British deaths combined are between 800,000 and 900,000. That compares to anything between 25 and 29 million for the Russians. For every American to die in the war, approximately 65 Russians died. In the process, they inflicted 93% of all German casualties prior to the D-Day invasion in June of 1944. And that invasion had previously been promised to them to relieve the German pressure in 1942 and again in 1943. It was not delivered until 1944, a 2-year delay that they considered deliberate and designed to bleed them to death. Even after the Normandy invasion, the Russian contribution to victory far exceeded that of Britain and the United States combined. In their summer of 1944 offensive that destroyed German Army Group Center, the Soviets inflicted 900,000 casualties on the Germans. That figure exceeded by 200,000 the total number of German forces deployed against General Eisenhower at that time. As for Roosevelt's supposed naivete in dealing with Stalin, the Soviet leader did not consider him naive at all. In June of 1944, he commented to the Yugoslav communist leader Milovan Žilas that if you turned your back on him for a minute, Churchill would steal a kopeck out of your coat pocket. But Roosevelt, he only, quote, "dips in his hand for bigger coins." More importantly, Yalta was a wartime conference, not a post-war peace conference. Its accords were wartime agreements designed to maintain the alliance until the Axis had been totally defeated and to keep the alliance together in the post-war era so that the Germans could not rise up yet again to start a Third World War. The peace conference never took place, however, because of the Cold War, which is why we tend to think of Yalta as a peace conference. In addition, Roosevelt did not give away at Yalta, or ever give away to Stalin, any territory occupied by U.S. soldiers. Indeed, at Yalta, he struck some very favorable bargains with the Soviet dictator, despite the relative weakness of his military hand. Please realize, Yalta took place in early February of 1945. The Allies were just ending the Battle of the Bulge and really hadn't crossed into Germany yet at all. The Red Army, on the other hand, was within striking distance of Berlin. Despite these facts, Roosevelt obtained large German occupation zones for both the United States and Britain, and a zone for France, which Churchill wanted. He paid a modest territorial price in the Far East for still deeply desired Soviet entry into the war against Japan, given the casualties that the U.S. Army and Navy were suffering at that point. As for the atomic bomb, it did not exist at that time, and no one knew if it would ever exist. Furthermore, Stalin agreed to deal with Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government instead of Mao Zedong's communists in China. Roosevelt also negotiated favorable compromises on the UN veto and General Assembly votes. The promised free elections in Poland and the rest of Europe were the best that could be obtained in light of the fact that the Red Army occupied Poland and the rest of Eastern Europe. Was this appeasement, or was it hard bargaining and negotiation? And if appeasement, didn't Stalin and Churchill practice it as well as allies usually do in order to maintain the alliance and achieve their common goal of victory? Now, given these facts about the war, an obvious question arises. Why do we maintain our myths and our misconceptions? The reasons are numerous. First of all, many of these myths and misconceptions reinforce our preconceived ideological notions. Our faith in democratic elections, for example, is directly challenged by the fact that voters made the Nazis the largest party in Germany during the early 1930s. It is much easier to say Hitler seized power than to admit this. Other myths and misconceptions reinforce beliefs about ourselves that are in turn misconceptions, such as the belief that we were ever truly isolationist or naive for that matter. The overestimation of the American contribution to victory does reflect traditional ethnocentrism shared by our allies. You go to England, you will see they won the war. You go to Russia, you will see they won the war. But it also reflected a desire to downplay the critical Soviet contribution to victory. That desire was quite strong during the Cold War that followed World War II. In addition, admitting that victory depended on alliance with a bloody dictator would challenge our view that this was, quote, the good war. In addition to these factors, conspiracy theories, such as those about Pearl Harbor, feed into what the historian Richard Hofstadter aptly labeled the paranoid style in American politics. They also reflect, as we have seen, an anachronistic projection of contemporary knowledge of events onto policymakers of the past who did not have such knowledge. The Yalta myths also feed into this paranoid style, as well as the anachronistic projection of later military events, i.e. March 1945 to August 1945, onto early February 1945. No one knew in February that the German army in the Ruhr would be encircled in March and that other German forces in the West would crumble in April. Nor did anyone know that an atomic bomb would be successfully tested in July and used in August. In addition, there also appears to be a natural tendency to make and misuse historical analogies to support preconceived notions and plans. In this regard, the myths and misconceptions about World War II have proven very useful in justifying American policies since World War II. Indeed, just about every president since Franklin Roosevelt, with the possible exception of Barack Obama, has used the World War II myths in the collective memory to justify his own policies. Most notably, but far from exclusively, Truman in Korea, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, all in Vietnam, Kennedy again in Cuba, and both George Bushes in Iraq. These individuals were not necessarily lying. In all likelihood, they were not lying. Many, if not most, American policymakers believe the myths as much as the public does. But the events cited in Korea, Vietnam, Cuba, Iraq, by these presidents, had utterly nothing to do with the reality of World War II. And relying on this historical analogy has consistently led us to tragedy. Indeed, those tragedies emphasize the fact that faulty perceptions of history are in some ways more important than what actually happened. For people act on the basis of their perceptions. And when perceptions differ so dramatically from historical reality, they can and do lead to tragedy, as we will see when we turn to the Cold War.
Lecture 20. Was the Cold War inevitable?
World War II was followed immediately by the long Soviet-American conflict we know as the Cold War. Indeed, some people argue that it actually began even before World War II ended. Now, given such an interpretation, it is far from surprising that some of the World War II myths discussed in the last lecture feed into a series of myths about the Cold War. For example, belief in the World War II Yalta myths that Roosevelt gave away half of the world to Stalin at the Yalta Conference can logically lead to a belief that the Cold War could have been avoided had Roosevelt not been so naive. But if one does not believe in the Yalta myths, one can reach an opposite conclusion that is equally incorrect, that the Cold War was inevitable. It was not. And in this lecture, we will explore how and why the Cold War took place and lasted for so long. In the process, we will deal with additional myths about this long Soviet-American conflict. Now, historians analyzing the origins of the Cold War usually cite divergent and conflicting histories, interests, ideologies, and personalities. Let's look at each of these briefly. History first. Russia and the United States had always possessed diametrically opposed political systems. Centralized autocratic tyranny for Russia versus decentralized democracy for the United States. Why is an interesting question. Perhaps geography. Russia, with a history of consistently being invaded across the open plains of Eastern Europe, may have needed centralized power to defend itself. The United States, protected by ocean moats, did not need centralized power. Now, despite this difference, the two nations had been friends throughout the late 18th century and most of the 19th century. Why? Because their interests did not collide during this time period and because they shared a common enemy, Great Britain. That was an enemy who sought to check the continental expansion of each of them, Russia in Eurasia, the United States in North America. And both the Russian and the United States governments operated on the basic principle in international relations that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Yet, there were predictions in the 19th century that these two expansionist powers would eventually collide. Secretary of State William Henry Seward wrote in 1861 that, quote, Russia, like the United States, is an improving and expanding empire. Its track is eastward, while that of the United States is westward. The two nations, therefore, never come into rivalry or conflict. Each carries civilization to the new regions it enters, and each finds itself occasionally resisted by states jealous of its prosperity or alarmed by its aggrandizement. Russia and the United States may remain good friends, Seward concluded, until each, having made a circuit of half the globe in opposite directions, they shall meet and greet each other in the region where civilization first began. Even earlier, 25 years earlier, in fact, Alexis de Tocqueville had ended the first book of his famous Democracy in America with the following, quote, "There are now two great nations in the world which, starting from different points, seem to be advancing toward the same goals, the Russians and the Anglo-Americans. All other peoples seem to have nearly reached their natural limits and to need nothing but to preserve them. But these two are growing. Each seems called upon by some secret design of Providence one day to hold in its hands the destinies of half the world." Now, Seward's prediction of the friendship ending when the United States and Russia found their expansions colliding became a reality at the end of the 19th century, when their interests did collide in Manchuria. Interestingly, at the same time, the Russian government was cracking down on dissidents, and Americans were becoming more aware of Tsarist repression and condemning it. Ideology became much more of a factor as a result of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, which established the communist government in Russia that claimed its ideology of communism was the wave of the future. This took place at the very moment Woodrow Wilson was restating and expanding the American mission to recreate the world in its own image. The two nations thus had diametrically opposed and universalist ideologies, with each one claiming to negate the validity of the other. Not surprisingly, given that fact, the United States participated in Allied military interventions in Russia in 1918, at least partially designed to overthrow the Bolsheviks. It also refused to recognize the communist government of Russia until 1933. Now, reinforcing the ideological conflict was the mentality of the Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, a bloody tyrant who many argue possessed a paranoid personality that saw enemies everywhere and who in the 1930s had murdered all his potential rivals, as well as hundreds of thousands, if not millions of others, through his brutal domestic policies. Yet, none of these differences prevented the two nations from collaborating effectively as allies along with Great Britain during World War II. What had changed by 1945 was the fact that they had succeeded in totally defeating Nazi Germany and Japan. With their common enemies gone, there was nothing to offset their old differing interests and ideologies. A related factor was that Roosevelt had died in April of 1945. His successor, Harry Truman, did not possess Roosevelt's skill at compromise, nor the respect that the Soviet dictator had had for Franklin Roosevelt. Given these facts, some post-war conflict between the two wartime allies was probably inevitable at the end of the war. But conflict, however serious, is not the same as 45 years of global hostility and the constant threat of World War III. Indeed, conflict between these two nations had existed since the 1890s and had not led to any Cold War before now. What had changed from previous eras, and changed quite dramatically, was the world in which these two nations existed. World War II had created a massive and unprecedented global power vacuum. Germany, Italy, Japan, all totally defeated, occupied, no longer major powers. Nor was France a major power, or any of the other nations of Europe that had been conquered and occupied during the war by the Germans. Nor was China, which never really had been a great power during the war, and which was now on the verge of civil war. Nor was Great Britain, who despite the Allied victory, had been massively weakened by the war effort and who, as a result, would soon lose its overseas empire and its ranking as a great power. In effect, only the United States and the Soviet Union remained as great powers, and their power had grown so substantially during the war that they were, in effect, superpowers. And as their differences became obvious after the defeat of the Axis powers, each began to see the other as its major adversary and to view the entire world as a zero-sum game in which a victory for one was a defeat for the other. Each also tended to view the other through the prism of the events they had just lived through, and thus as potentially similar to the Nazi enemy they had just beaten. The historical lessons they took from that World War II experience were never to appease and to negotiate only from positions of military strength. In addition, each viewed its own ensuing actions as defensive reactions to the aggressions of the other, thereby leading to a constant escalation of conflict. Yet, they were also incapable of defeating each other militarily, even before the advent of nuclear weapons. In August of 1944, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had issued a study which pointed out that neither Russia nor the United States could defeat each other, and had pointed out that there would be, after the war, a shift in the global balance of power unprecedented since the time of Rome. Nuclear weapons only reinforced this perceived military stalemate. Now, given all of these factors, it is far from surprising that conflict between the two powers quickly erupted and escalated from 1945 to 1946. First came conflict over the boundaries and government of Poland and the other countries of Eastern Europe that had been occupied by the Red Army. Cries on each side that the other was breaking the Yalta Accords. Then quickly came conflict over policies in occupied Germany, with the Allied Council of Foreign Ministers unable to reach any agreement on a combined policy or on a final peace treaty with Germany. There never was a final peace treaty with Germany. The dropping of an atomic bomb by the United States without informing the Soviets in advance of this weapon heightened Soviet suspicions and fears of the United States. Similarly, the later discovery of communist spies in the wartime atomic bomb project increased American suspicions of the Soviets, and the activities of local communist parties in Europe only heightened American suspicions and fears. Now, these communist parties had gained enormously in power and prestige during the war because of their anti-Nazi resistance activities. But Americans perceived them as stalking horses for the Soviet Union. That was a perception strongly reinforced by the so-called fifth columns of the fascist powers that they had witnessed before World War II in such countries as Spain and Czechoslovakia. And as these local communist parties took power in Eastern Europe behind the Red Army and looked like they could win elections and take power in Western Europe, American fears grew of a Russian red fascist takeover of all of Europe. The ideological conflict between the two, which lay dormant during World War II, had reemerged in early 1946 with two major speeches. First, a major February speech by Stalin, in which he revived talk of conflict with the capitalist countries as well as between the capitalist countries. That was soon followed in early March by a major speech by Winston Churchill in Fulton, Missouri, with President Truman sitting on the stage, during which Churchill warned that a, quote, iron curtain was descending across Eastern Europe.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Then a year later, in 1947, when Britain informed the United States that it could no longer afford to support the Greek government against communist guerrillas or Turkey against Soviet pressure, the United States, with the famous Truman Doctrine, replaced the British in both Greece and Turkey and announced a global policy to, quote, support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. And with the failure of the March-April 1947 Foreign Ministers Conference in Moscow, new Secretary of State George C. Marshall proposed in early June the European Recovery Program that bears his name, the Marshall Plan. Now, the European Recovery Program would require and include the economic rebuilding of Germany, which Stalin feared and opposed. He was invited to join the European Recovery Program, but he interpreted it as designed to disrupt his empire in Eastern Europe. Consequently, he rejected participation, he forced his European satellites to do likewise, and he clamped down in the satellites where there was still a degree of freedom, most notably Hungary in late 1947, and then in early 1948 in Czechoslovakia via a coup. 1948 was the 10th anniversary of the Munich Conference. And what we see here in the United States is the role of historical memory as a major war scare ensued. Then, just 4 months later, in an effort to halt the rebuilding of the western zones of Germany and the formation of a West German government, Stalin also instituted a blockade of the western zones of Berlin. Berlin lay totally within the Soviet occupation zone for Germany as a whole. That led to the Berlin airlift by the United States. It also wound up escalating the formation of a West German government rather than stopping it, and the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization by 1949 with the United States as a member. The first peacetime alliance in American history, unless you want to count the continuation of the War of Independence alliance with France after that war. Now, all of this was part of a new American policy enunciated in 1947 by State Department official George F. Kennan to contain Soviet expansionist tendencies. This policy, Kennan asserted, would lead either to a mellowing of the Soviet system or its total collapse. But containment also led to a major expansion of American power as the United States moved into areas around the Soviet empire. And thus Soviet perceptions of American aggressiveness necessitating a Soviet response. This mirror image effect by 1948-49 led the two superpowers to the edge of World War III. But World War III did not occur. Neither side wanted it, and in all likelihood, neither side could win it. Indeed, by 1949, the two superpowers had in effect divided Europe into spheres of influence, spheres which each was willing to go to war to defend. Each side knew that about the other. As a result, and rather ironically, Europe began the longest period of peace in its modern history, a long peace that did not end until the Cold War did 4.5 decades later. But if peace had resulted from this division of Europe, why did the Soviet-American conflict not end at this point? Well, one key reason was that by this time it had expanded to the rest of the world because of the global power vacuum that I previously talked about. Indeed, in Asia, it resulted in a hot war instead of just a cold one by 1950. In China, civil war between the Chinese communists under Mao Zedong and the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek broke out soon after Japanese defeat. And in October of 1949, Mao's forces won and Zhang fled to the island of Formosa. Although his defeat had long been predicted and expected by experts in the State Department, it sent shockwaves through the United States because of the public's long-held perception of China as an American ward. And this loss of China became a highly charged partisan issue that Republicans now used against the incumbent Democrats. The loss of China also took place at the same time as a series of spy cases and Soviet detonation of its first atomic bomb, all of which resulted in an anti-communist hysteria in the United States known today as McCarthyism. Then in early 1950, Mao went to Moscow and signed a treaty of alliance with Stalin. Meanwhile, the peninsula of Korea, previously part of the Japanese Empire, had been divided by Russian and American occupation forces, much as Germany had been divided by occupation forces. Russia and the United States had then each established a rival government, one in the north, one in the south. Now, that division may have suited the two superpowers. It did not suit either Korean government. Both of them threatened to unify the peninsula by force. With Stalin's acquiescence, if not his blessing, the North then invaded the South on June 25, 1950. The Truman administration interpreted this as a Soviet move that could not be tolerated. In a telling analogy showing the impact of World War II thinking, Truman asserted that it was Nazi Germany's 1936 forcible military occupation of the demilitarized Rhineland all over again. And taking advantage of a Soviet boycott of the United Nations Security Council due to its refusal to replace nationalist China with communist China, the United States obtained UN sanction for a military intervention to halt the North Koreans. Led by General Douglas MacArthur, U.S. and U.N. forces first halted the North Koreans and then routed them via a surprise amphibious landing at the port of Incheon. The administration then decided to take advantage of this victory to unify North and South Korea by force, with MacArthur's forces crossing the 38th parallel dividing line and moving north toward the Chinese border on the Yalu River. That led to a massive military intervention by the Chinese communists, who viewed this U.S. military movement as a mortal threat. The result was a much expanded war that now threatened to turn into a full-scale global world war. The Truman administration now reverted to its previous aim of liberating only South Korea, and U.S. and U.N. forces fought their way back up the peninsula. When MacArthur refused to accept this policy and pressed for an expanded war with China, he was dismissed with the concurrence of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As Joint Chiefs Chairman General Omar Bradley put it, to expand this war would be the wrong war at the wrong place at the wrong time and with the wrong enemy. An armistice was signed in 1953. That same year witnessed major changes in leadership on both sides, as Dwight Eisenhower became president and Stalin died and was replaced by Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev denounced Stalin and called for a more open society. And for a brief moment, there appeared to be the possibility of a thaw in and perhaps an end to the Cold War. But instead, the Cold War intensified and expanded into new areas. Partially, this was because the pace of decolonization increased during the 1950s and 1960s, thereby opening new areas for superpower competition. But equally, if not more important, the patterns of thought and behavior that had already been established could not suddenly be reversed. Indeed, Republicans had come to power condemning the Democrats as being soft on communism and could not now reverse themselves. And the anti-communist hysteria was at its height. Indeed, both American political parties had learned by now that to be, quote, soft on communism was to court defeat and disaster. Meanwhile, in the Soviet Union, anti-American propaganda continued while Khrushchev halted reforms and used brute force when it became clear, as witnessed in Hungary in 1956, that those reforms could lead to the demise of the Soviet Empire. The Cold War thus continued and expanded across the entire globe, and it became hot again in Vietnam, which will be the subject of the next lecture. But it remained cold in terms of direct Soviet-American military confrontation, with massive numbers of nuclear weapons on each side, creating a balance of terror that maintained the peace, albeit always at the verge of a miscalculated nuclear holocaust. By the late 1960s and early 70s, however, the bipolar world that had come into existence in 1945 no longer existed. Instead, new centers of power had emerged as Europe recovered from World War II and China emerged as a major player. And as China's major split with the Soviet Union became public and more intense, leading to armed border clashes by 1969. Sensing both the limits of American power in Vietnam and the possibilities inherent in the Sino-Soviet split, U.S. President Richard Nixon and his National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger pursued a triangular balance of power approach that led to a major lessening of global tensions. As a former hard Cold Warrior, Nixon was able to use his reputation to sell this policy of détente to the American people. As the cliché asserted, only Nixon could go to China. And predictions arose that the Cold War might finally be coming to an end. But it did not come to an end. Instead, the Nixon-Kissinger détente ended by the late 1970s, and a new hot war emerged as the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan to prevent the collapse of its puppet government there and a victory by Islamic fundamentalists. Now, in retrospect, this event in Afghanistan and the simultaneous Iranian Islamic Revolution constituted the wave and face of the future. And it threatened both superpowers, but they remained locked in their old conflict and did not see this. Instead, both Democrat Jimmy Carter and his Republican successor Ronald Reagan reacted strongly to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and supported the Islamic forces. Reagan also attacked the entire notion of détente, and a new and fierce Cold War that thus began. It is a new and fierce Cold War that we tend to forget because of what happened in the late 1980s. But it was one that nevertheless had many people thinking they were once again on the brink of World War III. The Soviets shot down a South Korean airliner bound from Alaska to Seoul, South Korea. The nuclear arms race accelerated, and some people talked about actually winning a nuclear war. Now, World War III, of course, did not occur. And for two basic reasons. First, the old generation of Soviet leaders died, and a new, young Soviet leader from a younger generation, Mikhail Gorbachev, instituted major reforms in Soviet domestic and foreign policy. Those reforms summarized by the terms glasnost and perestroika. Secondly, rejecting the advice of his hardline advisors, Reagan embraced the reforms, and with Gorbachev instituted a new era of Soviet-American cooperation. The Cold War finally did end between 1989 and 1991, when glasnost and perestroika led not only to reform and a lessening of Soviet-American tensions, but to the total collapse of first the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and then the Soviet Union itself. Well, what then was the Cold War and why did it last so long? It was in one sense not a war at all, but a state of abnormal bipolarity following World War II that could have, but never did, result in World War III, because neither side thought it could militarily defeat the other. Yet there were numerous bloody regional wars fought within the Cold War, including Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and a series of civil and regional conflicts fought by proxies. Now, as previously stated, conflict may have been inevitable when World War II ended, but the duration and intensity of this conflict was not. That intensity and duration resulted primarily from domestic and ideological factors in each country that, in retrospect, were almost totally at odds with the international realities after 1949, or at the latest after 1953. Without those domestic and ideological factors, the Soviets and the Americans could and should have ended the Cold War either with the European stalemate of 1949 or the Korean armistice and death of Stalin by 1953. But ideological and partisan political hysteria prevented that on both sides. So did the fact that thousands of American soldiers had lost their lives to international communism in Korea. After that, no American politician dared act in a way that could lead to accusations that he was soft on communism. Similarly, Khrushchev and his successors halted reforms when it became clear from events in Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia that those reforms could lead to the end of the Soviet Empire. They also severely limited their contacts and relations with the United States for fear of the impact on their people. Instead, they continued their propaganda against, quote, American capitalism and imperialism. But ironically, monolithic international communism never really existed. Witness the Russian-Yugoslav split by 1947, the Sino-Soviet split a few years later, and many others. In fact, one could say the real conflict was never about ideology at all, though many thought it was. Rather, what you had here was a global power conflict between Russia and the United States in a uniquely bipolar world that followed World War II. The real threat for the United States in this regard was never communism per se, but Soviet power and its ability to expand into the global power vacuum that existed at the end of the war. The early Cold Warriors clearly recognized this, as well as the limits of American power and the dangers of creating a garrison state in the process of combating the Soviets. Marshall, Kennan, Eisenhower all realized this and warned about it. As Kennan put it, the greatest danger that can befall us in coping with the problem of Soviet communism is that we shall allow ourselves to become like those with whom we are coping. Eisenhower, in 1961, warned Americans of the military-industrial complex. Containment was thus originally designed as a non-military and limited economic policy for Europe. But such limited concepts of containment changed in 1950-51 as the Cold War became global and hot in Korea, leading to the globalization and militarization of containment despite the continued objections and warnings by these individuals and others. And although the Republicans in 1952 attacked containment as defeatist and promised a more aggressive policy of liberation, containment remained the American policy under Eisenhower and then under Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush, albeit, as the historian John Gaddis has pointed out, with different strategies and different emphases in each administration. In this regard, and again contrary to more recent mythology, Ronald Reagan did not win the Cold War or abandon containment. He maintained containment, albeit with different emphases. And if containment did succeed in winning the Cold War, the credit belongs to all administrations from Truman through Reagan and Bush. All of them desired to end the Cold War. None of them proved able to do so until the late 1980s. Was the conflict inevitable? Some Russian-American conflict probably was inevitable after World War II, but not the 45-year global conflict that left hundreds of thousands dead around the world and left the entire planet on the brink of World War III and nuclear annihilation. Indeed, as one of my students once wrote in response to an essay question regarding whether an earlier war, 1812, was inevitable, he answered it was not because no event in history is inevitable, even though it may appear that way in hindsight. Even that economic determinist Karl Marx asserted that man makes his own history, though often not out of cloth of his own choosing.
Lecture 21, The Real Blunders of the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War, aptly labeled by historian George Herring as America's longest war, was also one of the most unsuccessful and internally divisive conflicts in American history. Indeed, the reasons for our failure in that war continue to divide Americans today. Many blame President Johnson and his advisors in particular for attempting to micromanage the war and for placing impossible limits on what the armed forces were allowed to do. In the famous words of actor Sylvester Stallone, as he went back to Vietnam in one of his Rambo movies, "Do we get to win this time?" Others blamed the armed forces themselves for using a counterproductive military strategy. Still others blamed the domestic anti-war movement and/or